Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Inside College Soccer. Today, I've got one of my social media coaching friends. We've been interacting for, I don't know, a long time, huh, Sinead, on social media. And we were reaching out to each other, talking about, I don't even remember what the subject was, to be honest. But I thought, oh, you'd be fantastic to have on Inside College Soccer. Bring your perspective to it. So welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Don. Appreciate it. Probably been a long time coming, but yeah, excited to learn today and have a great conversation.
You're just one of those coaches where, look, I know I don't always click with everybody. The things that I say sometimes, some consider controversial, but I just speak from my experience as a coach. And so I guess we were just, we kind of sync with how we feel about how we should treat our players and how, and what our jobs are as coaches.
Yes. I mean, I think I'm somebody that, having grown up in London, England, with it being a very vibrant city and having had many different experiences maybe throughout my life, I consider myself officially old now. I'm in my early 40s. I've crossed the line and have started to have some graduate assistants that either are younger women coming through the ranks and interested in coaching. Obviously, you want to try to give them as much insight or help that you maybe didn't have when you were a young coach. And probably one of the biggest learning pieces for me was just trying to meet people where they're at and understanding those differences, but also recognizing that everybody's opinion is coming from somewhere, mostly good is the way I like to think about it. People call me sometimes a hopeless optimistic, but that's just kind of maybe rooted a little bit in my faith, but then also just the different experiences that I've had.
I think it's important, Sinead, when we remember that we are, I always looked at our job as a college coach as like finishing school for young adults. I mean, we are taking kids from this important phase of, I don't think anybody are, you know, that's in their 30s or 40s or 50s and me in my 60s thinks that 18 years old is actually an adult. But we would hope that when they leave at 22, 23, that they're ready for adulthood. They're ready to take on the world and doing whatever they're going to do. And the parents aren't there on a daily basis for their kids anymore. It tends to be us. I know it used to drive some of our faculty mad when I would call our players kids, but those were also faculty members who had, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 year olds. So wait till your kid is 18, 19 and tell me they're not still a kid. So I guess my point is that I always looked at our job as taking our kids, the players, into that finishing steps of adulthood. So the way that we raised them, the way that we treated them, the way that we demanded things of them had more to do with taking them into adulthood really than how to play the technique and tactics of the game.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think, you know, nowadays it's probably a little bit more of, as coaches, where, you know, you've probably heard the same phrase, where the first adult in their life to maybe tell them no. And I'm not a parent yet, so I cannot, you know, truly gain that experience from what our parents have to deal with. But I have probably more so in the last few years tried to be more patient with the folks that come into our program that are away from their parents, who are used to a certain way of being told what to do, and just trying to, again, be patient in their development of what that looks like. Everybody has a different continuum of where you meet them in their life and then how they're going to exit your program. You know, some people exit, we're on good terms. Some we exit on mutual terms. Very, very seldomly do we exit on poor terms. But somewhere down the line, even now, looking back on however many years I've been here, 6, 7, I'm starting to get a couple of those messages from alumni that, hey, I know you were just trying to push me, but I really appreciate it. And sometimes I hear that when I'm around parents and, you know, I'll chat to the parents after a game or, you know, maybe on senior night when we're grabbing a beer or a bevy and, you know, their daughter will come back in and I'll start to understand the relationship a bit more. So for me, it's been really important to involve parents in our program. I know that's really hard for some coaches and it's been hard for me, but the more I can learn kind of a little bit about the relationship, the more I can either help my player or I can potentially, you know, maybe water down a little bit of the sensitivity of, you know, parents' frustrations really about their own daughter, which, you know, I understand where that comes from also. So it certainly does feel that there is more to this than the tactics, which is why I've loved Division Three, why I've loved St. Lawrence. We generally have a very happy campus. I've always joked, I was joking with the lacrosse coach yesterday. You know, our players, our athletes, our students, they always, you know, end up being all right in the end. And we're the ones like stressing about some of the silly pieces that ultimately keep us up at night, which deservedly so. But, you know, for the most part, if they're having a good experience, then they may not leave here thinking they've improved, but somewhere in that reflective period, you know, they come back and not necessarily say thank you, but they come back with a story about their journey from leaving your program to, you know, finally recognizing what you were trying to teach them or give back to them.
Yeah. And sometimes that is years later, honestly. And it's, and I've always said, I was never so stubborn headed that I thought that I was you know, it was always the player's fault, right? I always felt that if it wasn't working out, that it just simply meant that I wasn't the right coach for them. That's it. It's important for us coaches to remember that our personalities aren't going to jive with every single kid out there. And it may not be our fault. It may not be the kid's fault. It's just that the match wasn't right. I guess it's the same reason why certain marriages or relationships don't work out, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that either one's a bad person. It just means it didn't work out. And that can happen. So how did you're from London. How did you end up in the United States?
Essentially, I got into my late 20s, was still playing, you know, at that point, I think I was in the reserves at Millwall Lionesses. I was teaching, I was head of department or head of girls PE. I was coaching in the, you know, the Center of Excellence at the time. That's what there were about 21 Center of Excellences in England connected with the clubs.
For those that don't know, real quick, what would you equate that to in the United States?
I think it's similar to the GA model. You know, on the boys' side, it was called academies. On the girls' side, it was called Center of Excellences. We really only trained 2-3 times a week. We played on, they played on Saturday mornings, and it was U10 all the way up to U16. From U16, you could go into the first team. So when I went to, I think I was with Crystal Palace at the time, you know, you're 16, but you're playing for the first team. That was the norm. And so I was still, my captain at the time, Prue Buckley, she had just got back playing, I think, in a World Cup, and she's 36 and our captain, and, you know, most of our younger players were kind of 16. So the Center of Excellence was probably not deemed an academy at the time because it wasn't 5 days a week, like the true essence of the FA academies. But, you know, most of our women's clubs were affiliated with the men's team at that time. And then our Center of Excellences were that pipeline that kind of fed into the first team and the reserves team. But it typically ended around U16. There may have been some teams starting to branch into U18, but my coach at the time, Jim Hicks, just said, hey, do you want to get involved in coaching? He always tried to have the first team members working in the Center of Excellence. And we'd often have those trainings right before our training. And so it was, you know, super handy, not very good pay, much like we all know that in this world. And so I just really loved the coaching. I loved the coaches that I had. I saw the impact that they were having. I loved teaching at the same time, but, you know, I was also working as a personal fitness trainer and trying to make ends meet so I could do more coaching. And eventually, right. Somebody on my UEFA B license, I think in 2009, just said, hey, have you ever thought about, you know, going to the States. And I had thought about it much younger. I had a coach reach out. I think it was somewhere in Florida. I really don't remember. I was young. I was like 15. I was pretty good at that point. But my mum felt ill and I didn't feel like it was right to really leave. I'm the eldest of three. And so I loved, again, my coaching experience, wanted to stay close to home. And yeah, pretty much at 29, you know, standard usual life mid-crisis, decided, you know what, I'm going to sell my apartment, my car, take a backpack and a big suitcase and go after this opportunity that someone had mentioned on my UEFA B. I had no idea what the opportunity really was. And it was an opportunity to be a graduate assistant coach with Stephanie Gabbert at Smith College, which is renowned to have a master's program geared towards coaching collegiate women's teams. And it was the best decision of my life. And I've been here about 15 years, maybe a bit longer. And yeah, that's kind of what got me to the States. Never looked back, never really wanted to go back home. And I've always enjoyed, you know, the opportunities that are here, particularly for women. You couldn't find a full-time job. You know, they're still rare back home in a full-time capacity. So yeah, that's kind of my journey in a nutshell. And, you know, the college base has been an opportunity to coach more than maybe what I was at Millwall twice a week. And it's also combined the opportunity to be in an academic environment, which is my teaching background.
Yeah, that is not the normal. That's not the typical pathway that international coaches from other countries take to come to the United States. It's usually they came into play and then maybe went on to grad school, and so that's how they got involved and then ended up staying. And I know quite a few hundred of them. And what you've done is by far the gutsiest way to do it. To pack up everything and sell something and sell everything and all to chase a dream. That's impressive.
Yeah. I mean, I know a few people that have done the same. I think it's just, you don't know at the time that you're staying, right? You've still got your family somewhere back home that if you need to jump on a couch and figure it out again in reverse, you can. But yeah, I just got lucky. I felt like that my whole life. I've been able to branch out and again, just not be afraid to try something new. And, you know, that's ended up, I've described myself as a little bit of a late bloomer in that sense, but I think it's just being open-minded. And again, that's that hopeless optimism that I have. And yeah, I just kind of, you know, took a chance and was grateful that the person that told me about it did when they did.
So what year was it that you were still a player in England? When was that?
I think it was probably around 2007 is when I kind of stopped playing. 2010 was when I came out here to the States. And then between 2007 and 2010, I was back and forth, like, you know, oh, I'll play again. At that point, I was very much in the reserve squad. We had a great squad. It was a fun group of players that, you know, are about my age. Some younger players coming through the Center of Excellence that also were trying to break into the first team. But I remember having a player on my U10 team at the, you know, a few years prior, who ended up coming out and being a goalkeeper for Hofstra. And now she's out here, you know, working in college. She works with Exact Sports. So I'm always joking with her. Her dad was our team manager, and his name's Tony. He is still a great man. And, you know, you just think about these connections. You kind of just see the U10 come through, teammate goes on to America, stays in America, a bit like myself. And now, you know, sometimes I do those camps and get to see her, you know, running those. So yeah, sort of pretty much started playing young and went all the way through to 2007, and then was back and forth. You know, it's hard to stay away from the game at that point, and I was still coaching, so I wanted to play and model things, you know, as much as I could.
So the reason I asked that, so my son was over in England in 2003, I think, 2003, 2004, 2005, playing it at Bath University, had a special setup at the time called Team Bath. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like the model that the US men are now proposing where a lot of the kids went to university, but it wasn't necessarily a university side. They were actually in the league system, trying to work their way up through it. What I noticed when we went over and visited is that the attention, lack of attention that the women got were shocking to me, having come from America, where I was coaching in college women at the time, and there was zero difference between how the men and the women were treated. The facilities were the same, you know, they got to train on the same fields, and the quality of coaching was as good, if not better. There was just no difference in how they were treated. And when I went over to England, I was just dumbstruck, awe-shocked at how poorly the women were treated. You know, they had to train on different facilities than the men, using older equipment than the men. The quality of coaching, you know, wasn't the men. In fact, you know, when I was over there and some of the coaches would say, oh, so you coach in America? Yeah. You coach women. Why? Why are you coaching women? What are you doing? You're wasting your time. It was the attitude. And I noticed that in Argentina. I noticed that in England. And of course, things have changed a lot. You know, I don't think England women, you know, in the 2000s were even thinking about winning World Cups or competing in World Cups. And the quality and the standard was very poor compared to the USA, who was ruling the world at the time. But boy, what a change that has been made. I think everybody knows that. But I guess my question to you is, was that a cultural shock to you when you got here? Was it a pleasant surprise? Were you, what did you notice about, and how did you feel about that when you came to the United States?
Yes. I mean, it was a cultural shock, even though I was semi aware of it. I kind of grew up with parents who were Irish that loved the United States. We vacationed there, you know, once as a family. I think just maybe the Irish background piece, the goal is always to get somewhere else at the time, and so kind of that mentality was something I was brought up with, like there's better someplace else if you're willing to put the work in. And so I followed the US women's national team, you know, that was the first poster on my wall was Mia Hamm. I couldn't believe the crowds that were there. You know, I didn't really see the facilities because it was on a national team level, so I just assumed it was going to be better. But certainly when I came out here, I was just not only shocked by the equity, so to speak, from a first glance. I know behind the scenes there's still some inequities, but just even the facilities here at St. Lawrence, like it looks like a Division I school. And I just couldn't believe that was an option for every sport, not just soccer, but it was a thing. Like going to, you know, even going to high school games, I was like, my mum and dad, I mean, if I were lucky, would drop me off. Otherwise, it was two buses and they were like, see you later, have a great time. But no one came to our high school games, not even, you know, the man down the road that just wanted to watch some football or whatever. So the sheer enormity of just how much sport is, you know, an impactful part of your culture. And then also the majority of people have played some type of version of sport, whether it's intramurals or, you know, pickup, anything like that. That was certainly like a bit of a mind shock. And, you know, we were, again, I think we were lucky at Millwall because we had some really great coaches like Kay Cossington, who is head of technical development at England. You know, she was one of the first female coaches I had. She really got the spark going for me that something was possible. She had her A license at that point, but just what her and Jim and others, the other coaches that we had, were trying to get from the men's side for us. You know, we had the typical hand-me-down jerseys and kits, but we did have similar training facilities in the end. They were one of the first clubs, I think, in England to really push that idea of professionalism, but Arsenal got there first and half our squad went to Arsenal. As for university, I mean, again, it's similar to that high school model I was giving you. You know, I think men and women's teams at Bath and probably University of Greenwich where I went, we utilized the same facilities. We were really lucky in that regard. I think we were semi-funded pretty well. I mean, a lot of the, you know, the five teams on each side, the women's side had three sides, the men's side had six sides, first team to sixth team. We were all lucky enough to be part of, like, we had players that, you know, were playing at Charlton, at Millwall, wherever. You know, a bunch of us went to British colleges. We got to represent. So we had a good level of play, but at the end of the day, I was still the coach. I was the manager. I was the bus driver. I washed the kit and I bought the beers on a Wednesday night. So it just doesn't, you know, reflect at all when you compare university to college, country to country. It's certainly improved. You've now got the likes of Loughborough and Durham that are modeling more of that US mentality. But going from that as a, you know, you finish university in England when you're, I mean, you finish high school when you're 16, and then you finish university when you're 19, maybe 20, and then you go to the States and you see that, and it's just incredible. So that's where kind of the dream always lived in the back of my mind. But when I got here, there was certainly a, oh wait, this is bigger than anything I've ever experienced in my whole life, and there's no way to even describe it. You know, I've had family members come over, and they're like, wow. So it's pretty cool.
It is cool. No, it really is. And it's crazy to me to see how it's grown and how it's changed even in my lifetime. You know, I old enough that I grew up when I was really young, it was pre Title IX. And I think the first, we didn't have a women's team in high school when I played there. So when Title IX kicked in, we had girls coming out for the guys team. And the coach's attitude was he just made us run for the first 3 weeks until all the girls quit. That was it. He goes, the balls will come out when the girls quit. If they don't quit, we'll deal with it then. But that was the attitude. And this is 1976, 77. So it was just to see it go from that. And then my first full-time jobs were coaching women. Mm-hmm. It wasn't on the men's side. I didn't start coaching the men's side until later in my career. To see how much it's grown and how much it's changed, and to see our girls game grow in the United States to this monster that it is with ECNL and GA and all the other various alphabet soup league names that there are. There's a lot of opportunities for women, and it's good to see, and it's great to see how much it's changed and growing still over in England. It's really been such a blessing to see it grow.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Sorry.
So I was just going to say, so you come over, you're at Smith. So you graduate from Smith. Where's your career take you from there?
So at the time when I was at Smith, I had started working for Manchester United, and at the end of, you know, my time at Smith, I just assumed, I don't know what's next. I need to get a job. You know, when you're on an F1 visa, similar to international students still to this day, you have this additional year on top to potentially find a job. And it's, you know, an OPT year. And the idea is that you find a job and potentially, you know, if you're good enough, maybe you'll get supported through some type of visa process or work permit process. Hadn't really had a lot of success finding anything, you know, coming out of graduate school. I've seen that even with my graduates, like trying to, you know, especially if they've come out of undergrad and they're coming straight to graduate school here with me, and then they're looking for that first full-time gig. It's just really hard to find that. Especially, I think I had no experience in the college game. I just barely figured out what recruiting was by the end of my 2 years at Smith. I couldn't believe how much time was spent on it and how big it was. But I just ended up going back home. I think I don't know if that was the year I went to abroad with United, but then I got a phone call from my best friend Carly, who was also on the same course, and she had taken a job at Husson University, a very small D3 school up in northern Maine, right near the University of Maine in Orono. And she was going there to be the part-time assistant, and just said, by the way, the head coach left. Would you be interested in coming back to being my part-time assistant? And I thought about it and for 2 seconds and said yes. She said, there's just two problems. It pays $5,000, but you can sleep on my couch. And I said, sure, why not? So I had to do an official interview. I remember doing it in the basement of my work at the time with the athletic director at the time was Bob Riasso. He's a soccer guy.
And legendary.
Yeah, Carly's dad, Jeff, was the men's coach at the time. So everything was working out, you know, semi-perfectly. But went back. they offered me to be the assistant strength and conditioning coach. So I took my CSCS that December. I got another couple grand. And then they offered me the lacrosse assistant position, which was another $5,000, basically. So I was finally up to like $12,000. The only issue again was I had never seen lacrosse in my entire life. I grew up playing a bit of hurling or camogie. You know, my cousins right. in Ireland when I go back. So I thought, well, this can't be too hard. It's got a basket at the end, which is not what hurling has. And I was trying to watch both the men's and women's, like, to figure out as many practices. And then someone finally told me, wait, the men's game is a lot different, which also blew my mind. I'm like, what do you mean they have different rules? So that wasn't super helpful. So we just ended up making my role kind of the conditioning coach, so making people run. But it was still a way to help the head coach at the time. It got me paid a bit more money. And, you know, I was very grateful again that Carly, Jeff and Bob had helped me figure it out. And, you know, I didn't need much at the time. So the couch ended up being a bed in a spare room. And, you know, I loved my time just being around a soccer family, and just, it felt like a year-long convention, if you will.
Wow. That is, again, that's a gutsy move. But, you know, I always say, I have a saying that those that are willing to invest in themselves and bet on themselves, that believe in themselves, you know, that's how you make it. If you're not willing to do that, why would you ever expect somebody else to bet on you and believe mm-hmm. in you and invest in you if you won't even invest in yourself? And that mm-hmm. was definitely an investment and a bet on yourself. You believed that you could make this happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you want to call it. I think that was part of it. And, you know, just, I had nothing to lose, I guess, in a way. It was just more so saying yes and being helpful to other people if they saw, you know, if they had a need. So I felt like the whole year I was filling different voids. And, you know, another coach that was able to come over and help was a good friend of Bob and Jeff's called Bob Barry. And he's a, you know, a senior Olympian, if you will. But he's written a couple books on goalkeeping. And I knew that if I was going to try to make it work after Hassan, that I needed to learn, you know, a little bit more in the goalkeeping sphere, because that typically becomes one of your main responsibilities as an assistant coach at Division 1, 2, or 3. So I was just trying to add more experience to my experience, not necessarily resume, but he was another tremendous resource. You know, he's 81, I think, at the time. And he just, you know, could still volley a ball, and such a great teacher. And he's also got a teaching background. So I kind of, you know, was able to just watch so many amazing different coaches do their craft. And that alone for me was a way to figure out, you know, what does my craft look like? Because I'd never really had, you know, aside from licensing, any formal mentoring around like crafting your philosophy or figuring out what type of future head coach you want to be like.
Yeah, that's so true. And that's such great advice for young coaches. That was my in to college coaching. I was a goalkeeper, and I had been coaching goalkeepers and went to one of my licenses. And the instructor actually asked me to put on the session because he didn't know what was going on with goalkeepers. And one of the people in the classes, she asked me to come be her goalkeeper coach at college. And that's such good advice for young coaches. If you really are interested in pursuing the college game, start taking some goalkeeper courses and learn how to coach goalkeepers, and not just the drills, but start learning the basics of the position. That's such good advice. That was a smart move. So how does that move go then after Hassan?
So at the time, another person that was on my course that was actually on the Smith course that was another graduate assistant with the women's team. So Carly was actually a graduate assistant of Mount Holyoke, because there were three of us graduate assistants. You can only have two per sport as Smith. So I don't know if Carly added late or what happened there, but she ended up at Mount Holyoke with a woman called Kanai. And then I was a first year GA, and there was a second year GA called Caitlin Okamoto. And so Caitlin went on to work at Amherst, which is in the NESCAC, with Jen Hughes. For a number of years, I think at least three. And so she was probably 2 years into it. And she called me and said, hey, another NESCAC school called Hamilton is looking for an assistant coach. And at the time, Hamilton was one of the first schools in the country, and also one of the first in the NESCAC to offer a full-time position as an assistant. Typically, those roles have you know, felt like a graduate assistant position. You know, they have the ability probably to sell the name and have folks, you know, from all over come in and work for a great experience. And, you know, at the time, people weren't able to compensate people maybe at that level, but Hamilton was going full throttle in all their sports with offering full-time pay and full-time assistant with benefit. So Caitlin put me in touch with Colette Gilligan at the time. I was about to fly home. I think I was doing another summer of work with United, and she said, can you come up for an interview? The only issue is I didn't have a car, so I was in Maine. I managed to either, I don't know if I got a bus or a ride to back to Northampton, where Smith was. And I had met an older couple. You know, Northampton is one of my favorite towns, cities to this day, if you will. People were just so friendly. I've always just found the American people to be like that. And I came across a friend of mine, Chris. I met his mom and dad, and his mom and dad semi like adopted me, if you will. So we go out for, you know, dinner and stuff. And I told them I was back and we had dinner, and they said, well, what's next? And I said, well, I have this interview in Hamilton, or at Hamilton College, but it's in, you know, central New York, 4 hours away. So I'm just figuring out how to get there by bus. And Marty, the mom, said, well, I'll just drive you. And I said, okay. I said, are you sure? You know, it took me a while to be convinced. I'm probably not somebody that typically loves being overly helped. And you know, she drove me out 4 hours out, had the interview with Colette. On my 4 hour ride back, Colette offered me the job. And the job, you know, was an ability to, at the time, I also was teaching. I was professor of like a, you know, physical education courses there. And so I was on like a J1 visa, if you will, which I've been on before. Okay. I came out to the States and did like Camp America 1 year. I was, you know, loved Colette. She was a small Irish woman from Dublin, Ireland. So that worked out great. And she was a Manchester United fan, but, you know, small and mighty. And another great decision. I felt loved being around Colette and her family. The team at the time was maybe back in the NESCAC, I think from the Liberty League, actually, but they're a founding member of the NESCAC. So it was really bizarre, you know, bottom of the table type, but really great women. And, you know, spent 4 or 5 years there. And right before I left, we went to the first round of the NCAAs.
That's amazing. Good turnaround story. I love it. Yeah. So, okay. So now you're leaving. It's time to move on. How do you figure that out next?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's been hard because this has been more of a family decision with my partner and I. My partner's actually from the North Country, which this area is, you know, known as. It's a upstate from upstate New York, if you will. I've had 7 great years here, 6 seasons. Part of it is also maybe I am ready for something a little bit new. I think I probably, this is my first head coaching stint. I think I've learned a lot. I've enjoyed the experience, like the families, the staff. Again, got really lucky with just being around really good people. Both from a community sense, but it just coincides with my partner's ambitions to, you know, this would be the year that we would make moves. My partner's still going to be here till May, though. Wants to see out a newer position that, you know, only started in July. So kind of wants to, you know, get at least a good year on the resume there. But for me, I decided that it was not a great time to step down in May or June for the program. So I just opted to, you know, resign around Christmas time. I had a good conversation with Franco Bari, who was the former women's coach here, has become one of my best friends and recently hired as the new athletic director. But wanted to tell the team in person. So waited till, you know, a couple of weeks ago when they were back on campus. So that kind of delayed, you know, applying for things, but I had a couple people that knew I was going to be looking and just asked for my resume, said, you know, I've got a friend of a friend who's looking for an assistant. But I see myself going back into an assistant role. I'm back to that, you know, let's try some things new. I've never done Division I, for example. So that's one potential card on the table right now. I really enjoyed being an assistant with Carly, with, you know, the crew at Smith. I've loved being a head coach, but I think I'm a really good assistant. But I also I'm feeling like, you know, we have this one opportunity before we get into the weeds of being, you know, not able to do these wild and wacky things of up and rooting again. So whilst we have this time, can we make it the best time that we have to really live and learn? And I see that in an assistant role mostly. And I very much see myself coaching the rest of my life. I'm not interested in administration. I see myself, you know, dying on the grass type thing. Easy funeral, just throw me under the field. You know, make it the best that I can. So this segment of my life is just more about, you know, who can I go help or who can I go learn from, but also maybe provide some opportunities just from having been a head coach and maybe the mistakes I made and wouldn't make. So a couple things have come up, but nothing super solidified. I mean, again, Carly offered her couch and said, come down to Richmond, you know, come work club and go volunteer maybe at some D1s or come and assist me. And that to me is always a great, you know, that's where I was going to go. And now there's some other options on the table that have presented themselves that I'm probably going to go with more. But, you know, it's going to be
tough.
Figure
it out. Yeah. You'll figure it out. You know, it's funny that you say that you talk of the way to hear you talk about being a head coach and assistant. And looking back on my career, at a certain point, I couldn't wait to be a head coach. And now when I look back on my 22 years, by far the most fun I had, my most enjoyable years were being an assistant. There's certain things about being a head coach that I do not enjoy. I don't enjoy having to directly deal with administration at all. I find administrators are just in their own world, and have their own set, fair enough, have their own separate set of concerns. And as a head coach, I had to deal with that. And I was, you know, always being drawn into the administrative quagmires that I had no desire to be in. And as assistant coach, I didn't have to deal with any of that. The head coach had to deal with that. And I could just deal with the players and training. Training was where I had the most fun. Games are great. I enjoy playing, but I really love training.
Yeah.
just more than I can imagine. I couldn't wait to go to training. I actually sometimes get so nervous on game days that I don't know that I enjoyed them that much. But man, training was fun. And I loved being an assistant in that aspect. And the recruiting piece. I love trying to find new talent. And on the East Coast, you have a challenge that we don't have out here on the West Coast. Out on the West Coast, it's so big, you know, from the Rockies West, it's such a massive area and not that many schools relatively. On the East Coast, it's massive population and the schools are all stacked on top of each other. You go to Jefferson Copper, you go to PDA, and you see, you know, 150 coaches that are all within 150 miles of each other, it feels.
That is correct.
That creates a boy, doesn't that create such a, I don't know. Let me ask you, how does that feel to be competing with everybody that's next door and so many of them in similar type programs, right? Either high level. I mean, when you talk about the NESCAC schools or the NUMACs or the Liberties, you're talking about, you know, some of the US News and World Report best schools in the world, all stacked on top of each other, competitive.
Yes, it's hard. I mean, I think I love recruiting. That's, you know, if I don't stay in the college game, I'll miss that greatly because it's getting on a phone call. It's trying to be different in your approach. Like, again, I enjoy families, so I'll often have them on Zoom or I'll offer Zooms, especially because I know they're the main drivers in the decision sometimes. And that a majority of our, you know, men and women I've seen over the last few years, you know, there's that detachment from home that gets more difficult. There's more homesickness, you know, there's more people asking for singles, if you will. Like, I think college is a very different landscape than even 5 years ago. So I think it's just about being creative about what does the school offer and how can you help these families feel at ease. So it is competitive. I mean, I feel good about when I'm talking to a player that's looking at particular schools. I also feel great when I'm talking to a player that hasn't even started the process. So it's hard. You got to have to stay on top of it. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the, I would say from a head coaching experience, I'm similar to you, Don. I love training. I live for it. I plan it for 2 hours. We have a 2 hour set. I could plan all day and go over it and talk about it with my assistants. You know, I love to see the players enjoy it, throw in some quirky things that make them enjoy it even more, or see them push on a red day when it's, you know, conditioning and whatever. I think for me, it's just been, you know, more difficult to, I want to coach more. I want to be able to master that craft. And even though we've got the 24 sessions in the spring now, it's just all the other stuff. You know, I don't want to be doing 5 million things that aren't necessarily always helping my team. I'll do it for the greater good of the department. I like our administration. I like the people in our department. I love seeing other student athletes. So I like the teaching, but it just compounds, right? And then you feel like you don't have enough time to put into the alumni or the recruiting or your team. And those three things to me are all that should really matter at this level. So yeah, and recruiting's become more of a beast, right? Like you joked earlier, but the alphabet soup of, I mean, no one tells us coaches, oh, by the way, we have E64 and here's what it is and here's where it's going to be. You know, you just find this out from players, recruits. They're like, oh, they're part of this new, and maybe I'm just not paying attention, which it could very well be the case. But yeah, it has become more of a beast, particularly as you're seeing a decline in people even going to school anymore, right? So I feel like our resources need to be better met and we need to be, you know, more strategic, but that takes planning and time that sometimes as a D3 coach you don't have, because your off season feels like in season, but not necessarily one that is geared towards your team and recruiting.
So you said that even in the last 5 years you've noticed the college landscape changing. In can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've seen it probably with just the amount of people that are choosing not to go to school or choosing to go to community colleges, which I, you know, my Zach and my former assistant of mine talk about it as being that, I think, an arena that isn't looked at more. You know, we don't have graduate school here at St. Lawrence, so we're a little bit limited in that regard. You know, I haven't ever had a fifth year stay throughout the pandemic. So we're slightly limited in that regard, but the landscape, I think, is, you know, people want different things in terms of what they want their college experience to look like, as opposed to, you know, maybe what it was 5 years ago when being a student athlete was all somebody really needed or wanted. Now it's, you know, I think it feels at times like folks are being pushed to do all the things, and whilst being well-rounded is a really promoted state of being. I think at this level, we should be helping people figure out their niche and those qualities and, you know, be careful about maybe how much load we're putting on our student athletes to try to be everything that they want to be and then everything that everybody else wants them to be. So it feels like, you know, whilst the D3 experience is largely holistic, you know, nowadays when it comes to even things like recovery, right? Recovery used to be go into the training room, get a bag of ice and out you go. Now that's become a 1 hour, here are 15 gadgets, have at it, because this is what the trends are telling you to do. Who knows if you even benefit from it, but the amount of, I think, energy that we're zapping from our student athletes just seems to be increasing, whether that's expectations from coaches, parents, stakeholders alike. I think that landscape is, you know, changing in that regard. And I would hope that it would become a little bit more, you know, niche, if you will.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. And I'm definitely noticing massive changes. There's been more changes in the last even 3 years, 2 years, than I saw in the previous 30 years. It's crazy how the college landscape is changing and how the player recruiting base is changing. All the leagues and the clubs and man, when you look at Twitter and you look at, you know, the players that now are, you know, the ECNL definitely made a massive change in the landscape. I guess you were coming in right at 2010 would have been, I think 2011 maybe was the first year of ECNL, maybe 12. It was right in there. And it was wild to me talking to one of my buddies out here in Vegas, talking about, we've got a new league and we're going to be traveling to Massachusetts and we're going to be traveling back east. And I'm like, why? You're 2 hours from Los Angeles or 3 hours from Los Angeles. why are you traveling across country? And it's a new elite league, and it's and boy, it has, you know, grown and grown. And when they added, you know, now the reserve leagues, the ECRL, you know, and now MLS Next and the GA, and you know, these partnerships, and it's changing every couple of years. There's something new popping up, some new idea, some new thought. What are your thoughts on all of these changes? And feel free to say, I refuse to answer on the grounds it might incriminate me.
To be honest, I mean, I think it's good that players have options. I think that that's important. I've always believed that there's a level for everyone, and that, you know, I haven't always agreed with the only however many percentage of high school players go on to play college. I think that's because some high schoolers are just playing sport because they love it. They have no intention to go to, we make it sound like it's more elite than it is. And it's certainly elite in some ways, but in terms of accessibility, unless you have, you know, this, you really want to go like high academic and high level. Yeah. That's going to create more competition, just like anything in life. But in terms of having an opportunity to play college soccer, I think that that's open to most people. Again, I don't know that you need to jump ship every time there's this new trend. And that's where I'm talking about that niche piece. I'm not saying that people need to narrow their focus, but they need help figuring out what their focus should be. They almost need an advisor in club sport, like they do in college, in high school, for the school counselor to help them with their application in college, like they have in college, to help them figure out, hey, you know, what are you good at? What do you want to maybe try to experience? And I think that's the issue. We give players and young people all these tools, but we don't give them experiences. And sometimes being on X team with a crappy experience, as long as it isn't, you know, the abusive kind, but if it's like a tough loss and whatever else, sometimes that's a good experience. You're just not going to benefit from it right now, as opposed to, you know, jumping around because families are just going to do what everybody else is doing. But I think there needs to be more advisors in those roles, where if you have a team that's 1 hour from your house versus 4 hours from your house, then it doesn't matter what league it is. And to me, I've had players that, you know, have been on a GA team, right, that were just as good as the ECNL and vice versa. And to me, it's indifferent what the level is. I think it just needs to be based on what potentially could help the player. I wish it was just one big thing and it was just A, B, C, D, E, F, or colors or whatever it may be. But that's, you know, when I was in the reserves at Millwall, we almost had a third team just to accommodate the amount of people. But everyone was was getting similar coaching. Everyone was under one umbrella. We all knew what league we were playing in. Everyone knew where to show up. So I'm not really well versed in the partnerships, to be honest. I do find it, you know, hard sometimes to wrap my brain around, you know, what is the end goal of this? You know, what is the purpose? And sometimes there is not a lot of strategy being delivered on the forefront that provides these young people with the things and resources they need to make the decisions. But I've seen great players at all levels. I've also seen not very good players at all levels. So, you know, that's where sometimes the pay-to-play piece can be hard. So I'm unfortunately not someone that has a great opinion. I wish I did. You know, I know folks complain about it, and rightly so. Again, it could be that, you know, I haven't delved into it enough, maybe because I knew I was leaving this role like in December. But yeah, I don't know. It's going to be, you know, again, it's interesting with the NIL piece too. I think that's, again, great. But hopefully at my level, if you can do it, great. If not, like, let's move on and get focused on what you need to focus on. Again, it just adds to that wide vision, if you will, of all the different distractions that eliminate the opportunity for the student athletes to become the best version of themselves. So I don't really have an opinion on which level is better, which club. I just wish there was a little bit more communication to the college coaches at times, which often, you know, there isn't. And everybody has limited resources at the college level. Some have more than others. So, you know, I typically, if it's a new league, I wait a year before I go see anything, to be honest.
Yeah, it does. I tell you what, it's So it's got to be, and it is. I mean, we speak to hundreds of parents and players, and it's very confusing to them what the right pathway is for their kid. And when we start out that broad, it's like, what's the best thing for my kid to do if they want to play in college? What's the best league to play in? And my answer is always going to come back to, who is your child? You know your child better than everybody. What are the end goals of your kid? What are they trying to accomplish? Look, for my son, it was to stay involved in soccer for the rest of his life. That's what it was about. So his pathway was completely different than somebody else who says, I coached a girl named Lindsay Dickerson who played at Stanford. 10 years old. I want to be a doctor. I want to go to Stanford at 10 years old. And that's what she did. And she played at Stanford and she became a doctor. And somehow, some way, she knew at 10 years old what she wanted. So we knew what her pathway had to be. And then if that's your pathway, that's fine. That means by 11, you need to be doing this. By 12, you need to be doing this. By 14, you need to be doing this. And these are your goals. And if you are able to achieve your goals on every step of the way, you will end up on track to be at a Stanford. But if you falter at any step of the way, then you're going to have to find a different way to reach your goal of being a doctor, because you're not going to play at Stanford. And she did the whole U.S. national team and all of that all the way through. And it's great. But if I would say the vast majority of kids at 18 years old, I always tell parents, it's the dumbest question I will ever ask a kid when I'm trying to interview them. It's, what do you want to do for the rest of your life at 16, 17, 18? It's a crazy question that we adults ask kids. Right. Why we're doing this? I guess we need some direction for them, but that's a lot of pressure to put on a young 16, 17, 18 year old, make a decision now. What do you want to do for the rest of your life? What do you want your major to be? When my experience says that about 80% of the players I ever coached in my 22 years changed their major at some point.
Yeah.
I've had kids come in as kinesiology majors and leave as art majors. It's like, wow, how far can you get away from the sciences to new art? That's pretty far away. And I think we need to allow kids to do that. It was always my knock on England, is that we're going to judge a kid at 16 years old. You're allowed to go to college or you got to go be a bricklayer. And it's like, that's crazy. And I've had kids that, you know, had to go on to their B levels and then come here to the United States and go on to get masters and PhDs when they were being judged at 16 years old, that they weren't going to be able to do that. And that was always my knock on the English system. But here in the United States, I feel like we've gone more down that road than allowing kids the flexibility, which is what college was always designed to do originally here in the United States, is let's all just take a couple of years of general education, all of us. Mm-hmm. Slow down a little bit. Let's get to about 20. Then you'll know what you want to do for your years 3 and 4 at 21, 22. You'll have some maturity. You'll have some experience. You'll have taken some classes. You'll have an idea. Maybe you'll intern a little bit and you'll have a better idea. And I feel like we're letting kids down. I feel like we're pushing them too early in life to just go be adults, like get out of the house and become an earner. I don't want to have you around anymore. Almost. It's like, what are we doing? Allow kids a little bit more latitude to grow 100%. Up and mature and figure out what they want to do.
Yeah, that's honestly why I love the liberal arts experience. I feel like it has allowed in the early part of their education to maybe figure out if everything you were doing in high school was transactional just for the resume to get into college, right? And what you want to let go of, because that's that well-rounded piece that was probably half of it was, you know, transactional. Now let's get to college and get niche experiences that help you figure out who you are, what you love, what you don't love, and it's okay not to love certain things, and it's okay to change your mind. But let's maybe get back playing the piano. Like, you can do that and get an academic credit for it at college. And then as you kind of go through the college system, which I love about the States, it's 4 years as opposed to England, which is a very quick 3. You get that half and half where you can, it's okay to narrow the focus, but you're still figuring out those niche experiences that most of my, you know, unless they're going to med school or, you know, pre-med, which we have a lot of pre-professional routes. There's some people that leave here and don't go follow their major. And I think that that's cool. But I think, again, there's no one maybe advising parents once they get to school that these things are okay, even though maybe some parents probably now have gone through that where they didn't utilize a specific degree for a specific career. But yeah, trying to get my, even my seniors, I'm like, hey, you want to go play in England? I can probably, you know, help you figure it out. Go play in Europe for a year. You're going to be, you know, who knows if there'll be any retirement by the time you lot are old, but you're going to be working the rest of your life. Why not? You know, your parents probably kill me for saying that, but I'm just like, dude, once you start working, it's hard to come back out because you're paying bills, you're contributing to retirement and different things, but you're so young. You know, some of them are still very young at heart and could use another experience, which is why, again, I love the study abroad component, because it helps them to figure out that niche, right? You're kind of forced a little bit more than even college. But yeah, it's tough. I think liberal arts for me will, you know, always prevail in that sense. I have so much admiration for the engineering schools. I'm like, wow, how do you know you want to do chemical engineering? And you know, they're badass at it, which is great, and they're really good players, and it's impressive. I don't know how they know that, but good for them.
Yeah, no, the MITs of the world, those kids are just, they're just built differently. They really are. I think a lot of it's just genetics, and it's how they're wired. It definitely different, definitely a different, I don't understand it because I was so far away from that. It wanted nothing to do with anything that was science and math based for me. It was all about sports. Yeah. And that really kind of brings me back to what we're talking about with the league. So when people say, hey, D1 is the best, yeah, it's best for a certain kid, for a certain player, for a certain person, certain D1 schools are the best for them, but other D1 schools may not be the right fit for them. And I hate it when people take all D1s and say D1s are this and all D2s are this and all D3s are this, and this is what NAIAs are about and this is what JCs are about. Like every school is the same, but like every person is the same. We are all so unique, and schools are all so unique. You know, if you've got 1600 women's programs approximately in the US, about 1300 men's, roughly a little more of each, but roughly, you might not have 10% of those that are fairly identical, you know, and you've got probably, you know, 10% are like this and 10% are like that and 5% are like this and 2% are like that. And you've got the top 1%, the MITs of the world that are like this. There's MIT and there's Caltech. You know, those are two very similar academic programs, but they couldn't be farther away, even sports wise and location wise, they literally couldn't be any farther away. But trying to understand, as you said, I think kids having somebody in their corner that's an advisor that can know the difference between Carnegie Mellon and Amherst and MIT and Caltech, and even if that's, you know, Colorado Mines, you know, so even if we're talking top schools that have engineering programs, there's a vast difference in the academics, in the location, in the cost of the schools, in how those schools are, and how you're going to have to finance the cost for those schools. And all of those schools could lead them down the same path to the same jobs. Sitting, you know, you could have a Colorado Mines kid sitting next to an MIT kid in a job or at a Caltech job at Skunk Works. They could be in the same job, but they took two different paths, and their academics and the athletics and the location and the cost were different. Yeah. And they end up in the same place, and families need to know that. And well, that's why we do what we do at SRUSA, but it doesn't have to be us. But families need to find somebody to put into their corner to help them. That was a really good point you made earlier.
Yeah, I think it's like you look at the investment. I mean, the cost of school is outrageous, right? So it's getting worse. It's not getting any better. And I can see why parents are very adamant. You're going to take this and then you're going to go to med school. You're going to not waste any time and get out quick so you can start paying back that debt with a pretty good salary being a doctor. Like, I understand that piece very much so. I think it's just like when you look at large investments from a business sector, you know, the top 500 CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, they all have advisors. Like, good head coaches have coaches, right? Everybody that is trying to do something well probably has a mentor of some kind. And this should be no different for those young people. You know, some of them might be blessed that their actual soccer coach is a mentor for them, but most soccer coaches, even at ECNL, coach two teams, are really busy, don't have the time even for IDPs, never mind a sit down. You know, I think the clubs that do it well are known, but again, it's hard. So, you know, if you're going to spend that much money on a college degree, you better be sure you have someone in your corner helping you out that is outside of maybe all of those things. And I think when you look at it on a macro level at the business sector, that's why those people get paid the big bucks, because they're making decisions, but they're going through either a board and then they have a sounding board too. So I think it's just this idea of mentorship outside of the coaching sphere and teaching sphere and parent sphere is really important.
Wow, that's such good advice. And that's probably a good place for us to leave it. I knew that we would come up with a gem or two in here to leave to parents and players. And I think that's just such great advice. So where can people find you if they ever have a question for you about something? I know you're such an open person, and I know you're here to help. Where can people find you?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn. I can provide that if that is helpful. Twitter, that space I utilize is like my mini coach ed. I kind of am always looking for different resources on and off the field. And then I'm also, you know, on Instagram, I think at, you know, Coach Sinead McSharry, that's probably, I think, you know, somewhere where people can message me and I'd be happy to message back. But either of those three platforms are good. I won't be at St. Lawrence for much longer, but, you know, if they catch my email before the end of February, I'll also be available to help people. And I'm more than happy to, you know, help in any way that I can.
And on Twitter, your handle is Coach Nene.
Yes. That was a name given by a player to me at Smith. My name's a bit difficult to say.
No, I love it. Nene. No, my players, a lot of my players from a couple of classes still call me Don Don.
There you go.
Yeah. So it's, I get it. No, it's, and we tend to hold on to those cherished memories as coaches when players care about enough about us to give us a nickname. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that player was very dear to me. So,
well, thanks, Sinead. I really appreciate you coming on with us, and you and I will keep in touch and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Thank you. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.